This week on Texas Scorecard Radio, in the news, the Trump administration halts funding on the Panther Island boondoggle. We'll also take a look at one of the congressional races where a couple of candidates are in hot water over their comments. In this week's interview, we talked to David Keating of the Institute for Free Speech on why Americans should be celebrating the 10th anniversary of the Citizens United decision. And we'll close with a guest commentary from former state rep Matt Rinaldi. Welcome to this week's episode of Texas Scorecard Radio. I'm your host, Tony McDonald, coming to you from the 1836 studios in Austin, Texas. You can find us on the web at www.texasscorecard.com. Without any more delay, let's get into this week's top news. I've got Robert Montoya up in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. Robert, you've done a ton of coverage, a ton of writing and reporting about these issues involving Panther Island, or as I call it, Kay Granger's Floating Island, this huge boondoggle in Fort Worth. And there's a big new development this week with the Trump administration getting involved. Tell us about it.
It is Kay Granger's Floating Island, but now it's kind of like barely floating at this point. So this week, the Trump administration released a bombshell. The board that oversees this project, the Trinity River Vision Authority, they had asked the federal government for about over $30 million to complete the design phase, but they said they need at least $10 million to stay on schedule with there being no delays with their progress, or as little as there is right now. The Trump administration came out and said that they are receiving, they're getting no funding for anything except just $1.5 million to do a feasibility study. Now, what's interesting about the feasibility study is that for years, there's been questions about whether or not a flood study was ever done, what basically cost-benefit analysis to show is this project even necessary for flood control. And it was interesting, I actually asked Representative Granger at a forum last Monday if there was a flood study, and she said yes, and the Water District has it. Well, the Texas Monitor done investigation found that, in reality, the Grangers had fought to make sure that Panther Island got an exemption where they wouldn't have to do this kind of study, because a study like this is necessary and needed before the U.S. Army Corps started.
Let's put this in context. You have Representative Granger, and of course, her son is benefiting financially working on this project, and it's been dragging on for years and years and years, and it's been said, oh, this is a great economic development thing, it's mass, oh, it's a flood control thing, but obviously it's to build, I jokingly call it this floating island, this huge development on the north side of downtown Fort Worth. This thing's been caught and mired in delays for years. Now the Trump administration is saying, hey, we want you to actually study whether this thing is even feasible at all. You would have expected that was something that would have been the first step, not, you know, step number 99 or wherever we are now.
Yeah, in fact, exactly. In fact, the Army Corps of Engineers, I had asked Jim Oliver, who's the general manager of the Water District, and the new program coordinator, Mark Mazzanti, I said, is there a flood study? Because Representative Granger told us this. They both said there is, and when they're responsibly talking about it, you know, they confirmed something that the Texas Monitor discovered, which is the Army Corps of Engineers had started a study, then stopped. And the only quote-unquote study that exists is an economic analysis done by the University of North Texas, which does not meet the standard of what the federal government requires for something like this.
Yeah, so Trump administration pumping the brakes on this project, saying no more funding for construction. Let's actually take a look at whether this thing's even feasible before we waste more money on it. I expect this has got to be an issue. Granger running a very tough election campaign. This has to be kind of putting this even more front and center than it already was in that reelection campaign.
Yes, it does. In fact, it really does throw questions on just how strong President Trump's support of Representative Granger is. You know, she's been basing her entire reelection campaign on the fact that he endorsed her back in December. But, you know, it's one thing to say, I endorse your reelection, but by his actions, he's not helping her pet project. Just how far does this support really go?
Yeah. Well, very interesting. Thanks for your reporting on it. And obviously there's more to come on this huge boondoggle, Keg Rangers Floating Island there in Fort Worth. Thanks for your reporting.
Thank you, Tony.
Next, let's turn to Carrie Cheshire, Vice President for Texans for Fiscal Responsibility, talk about a couple of big stories coming out of the Congressional District 22 race that's going on. Interesting stories, even if you don't live there, but particularly to those who do. Tell us a little bit about where that is first.
Well, great question, Tony. So Congressional District 22 is situated largely in Fort Bend County, Sugar Land, Pearland, but it actually extends into Houston. You've got a lot of areas in there from all the way from Southwest Houston hooking into almost Clear Lake, and everywhere in between.
Yeah, incumbent Congressman Pete Olson retiring from Congress, and so you have an open seat race there, and lots of candidates getting into it, and now some of them in hot water for comments they've made. Let's start at the top with Pierce Bush, one of the Bush clan who's running for Congress there in CD-22. What has he said that has gotten him in trouble with voters?
Well, that's right, Tony. Pierce Bush, the latest Bush princeling to say that it's time for a new generation of Bushes to run for public office. For those kind of keeping track at home, he's not the son of George W. Bush. He is the grandson of H.W. Bush through Neil Bush, the brother who didn't achieve anything in life. But he's actually in hot water for comments that he made writing to the Houston Chronicle on the election of Pope Benedict XVI, in which he accused American Catholics of being akin to Muslim terrorists.
Yeah, let's go in, like, specifically in this editorial. These are some really extreme things that Pierce Bush wrote about not just American Catholics, but American Christians generally.
Well, that's right, Tony. You know, what Pierce Bush wrote was, with the election of Pope Benedict XVI, Christians around the world will likely not be able to look forward to much-needed reforms within the Catholic Church. There are two major areas of reform that are needed to accommodate our progressive world society. So progressive world society, something you usually hear from George Soros, but here you're hearing it from Pierce Bush. He goes on to attack priestly celibacy, that's the prohibition on priests marrying, and the ordination of women, calling one Stone Age mentality, and Taliban-esque, referring, of course, to the Islamic militia in Afghanistan that his uncle has sent thousands of troops to go fight, and probably over 6,000 Americans have died fighting. Yeah. I don't think that over 6,000 Americans have died fighting the Catholic Church.
Right. And then the interesting thing is this isn't just an attack on Catholics. I mean, this is something that is common to, you know, like a majority of American Christian faith traditions are opposed to the ordination of women.
Well, that's right, Tony. Your branch of Lutheran doesn't allow the ordination of women. Southern Baptists don't ordain women. There's a huge majority, actually, of kind of Christians in America that don't ordain women.
Now, this is now the second time that Pierce Bush's comments have become a big issue in this campaign. Whenever he first declared, it was immediately out there that he had been out, you know, vociferously, not just kind of speaking out against President Trump, but like marching in left-wing protests against President Trump.
Yeah, what he really kind of put in his crosshairs was the travel ban, which said that, hey, we're going to be restrictive of people who from dangerous countries trying to come here. And he was marching with leftists saying, no ban, no fear, refugees are welcome here in the streets of Boston. In Washington, D.C.
Amazing. Amazing stuff. Now, let's move on to Pierce Bush in hot water over those comments. There's another candidate there who was getting some traction and then now getting a lot of scrutiny over his position on sanctuary cities.
Yeah, this is Fort Bend Sheriff Troy Nels in hot water for his position on sanctuary cities. The long and short of this issue is that Troy Nels has said that he's opposed to sanctuary cities, and he actually kind of was while he was sheriff. The problem is where he kind of wasn't, and that relates to his actual opposition to the teeth of the bill that would have allowed would have prevented city councils and sheriffs from preventing their officers from asking about immigration status. Troy Nels basically said this creates an us versus them attitude with law enforcement. Yeah, it kind of does. Them is the illegal aliens, the criminals, the people who are violating our laws, the people who should be deported from this country. Law enforcement ought to be an us versus them.
Yeah.
And he was one of the ones saying, well, no, this is actually going to make it hard for us to prosecute cases because we want illegal aliens calling the cops on each other. And we're not going to, obviously, we're not going to go ask the person who just called the cops and we're pretty sure is an illegal alien, hey, are you an illegal alien? We just want to go after, quote, the bad ones who are, quote, breaking the law.
Well, they're all breaking the law. That's the whole point about breaking the immigration laws. Real quick, before we finish, tell us who else is in the race. What are the other dynamics of that race?
So you've got a ton of other candidates. You've got Joe Walls, who's a small businessman and veteran running an aggressive campaign. Greg Hill, who's a former judge there. He's running an insurgent campaign as well. Kathleen Wall, a pretty known commodity in the Houston area, is also running in that seat. With so many candidates, we've refrained from making an endorsement in the primary, but we do look to be active in the runoff as the field gets winnowed and voters have perhaps a clear choice for a conservative versus an establishment candidate.
Well, appreciate your reporting on it. Thanks for telling us about that race.
Thanks, Tony.
Texas Scorecard Radio is a project of Empower Texans. At texasscorecard.com or empowertexans.com, you can find more news and daily updates from all around the Lone Star State. You can also find updates from Empower Texans and Texas Scorecard on Facebook and Twitter, and follow Empower Texans on Instagram. Texas Scorecard's News Digest goes out weekly via email and monthly in print. Subscribe online and find more information at empowertexans.com. Someone's always keeping score. We think it ought to be the taxpayers.
Well, it's great to welcome on the program this week David Keating, president of the Institute for Free Speech. David, you've been out celebrating something that is unpopular in certain circles, certainly a thing that is under attack in certain circles, the 10-year anniversary of the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision, celebrating as something that's very great and important for the free speech rights of Americans.
Absolutely. We don't want to leave out the second half of that case title. It's Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission. So you have to keep in mind what the Federal Election Commission is in charge of. It actually has nothing to do with elections at all, and it has everything to do with speech around elections. So basically, we have a federal speech cop ensuring that the spending basically on communications about candidates and by the candidates themselves, by parties, by individuals, by political action committees, is all regulated by the Federal Election Commission. And that's what the fight, Citizens United, was all about.
Yeah, and seriously, like, for people to understand out there, I think a lot of people miss this part of the picture, that these are regulations that in many ways apply to every single American.
Absolutely. You have to keep in mind what the case was actually about. You know, it wasn't some broad generality whether corporations could spend money communicating messages to the public about candidates. Here we had an organization, Citizens United, that wanted to make a film about Hillary Clinton during the 2008 election. That's when she ran for president. And essentially, it was illegal, at least under the reading of the federal election campaign laws, for that nonprofit organization to broadcast, to basically do a documentary on Hillary Clinton and buy time on cable outlets and, you know, video on demand and things like that to air the documentary, which is an amazing thing when you think about it. And during the oral arguments before the Supreme Court on the case, the government even claimed that it could prohibit publishing a book if the book had even a single sentence endorsing or opposing a candidate if the book was funded by a corporation. But we all know that every every major publisher in the country, you know, is a corporation.
Yeah, this was an interesting part of the decision that, you know, people gloss over it. They think it's about corporate personhood, which is just kind of a legal principle. They think that it's about corporations giving money to candidates, and it's not even about that at all. It's really about whether people can organize in businesses and in nonprofit organizations and speak about issues that are important of the day. And we all know that there is this element out there, publishers, newspapers, media organizations who talk about these things all the time. Yet there were these rules on the books to prohibit that.
One kind of, in a sense, strange thing in the federal election campaign laws and many of the state equivalents is there's an exemption for the news media, which I think is good. But you have to keep in mind the news media is almost always a corporation. They can coordinate as much as they want with a candidate under the federal election campaign laws, which means they could give essentially unlimited contributions. And people might say, well, yeah, okay, that's just a newspaper. But wait a second. Consider that it's no longer the case, but for many years, General Electric, which at the time was one of the top three largest corporations in the world, owned NBC News. So here we have like a major, huge corporation owning a news media outlet, and that corporation, through its news media outlet, was allowed to give essentially unlimited coordinated expenditures. Now, I'm not claiming that GE and NBC did that. There's no evidence that they did, but they could do it if they wanted to, and it's entirely possible that some news media outlets do coordinate with candidates to either, publish information about opposing candidates or go light on some others. In fact, right now, there's a big controversy with Bloomberg News, which has said it will not publish any investigative reporting on any of the Democratic candidates, but will do so on President Trump. So the news media is exempted by the federal election campaign laws, and, some wealthy interests are now, buying and or own the news media, whether it's Jeff Bezos, who's arguably one of the richest men in the world, owning the Washington Post, or Sheldon Adelson, I think, owns the Las Vegas newspaper.
Yeah, and so you have this distinction where they're saying, okay, well, news media can do this, but what the Citizens United decision at its core came down to was to say, well, a news media corporation isn't really any different than another type of corporation. GE owns a newspaper. Then there's, General Electric and General Motors can both speak on issues that are important to them.
Well, what the court said is that they could only speak independently. So a corporation could only either do its own speech, and in most cases, we have to put some perspective on this. Virtually all the corporations that are speaking out about campaigns and candidates are nonprofit corporations like Citizens United or the Sierra Club or the NRA or, groups like that. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Planned Parenthood, on and on and on. There are lots of corporations. In almost every single case, they're nonprofit corporations. Now, the predictions by President Obama after the Citizens United decision is that it would, unleash a flood of corporate money and special interests to spend without
limit. Yeah, basically, corporations are just going to buy the government now that Citizens United has been decided.
Yeah, but what actually has happened is basically none of the public traded corporations, except for Chevron, have donated any money to any independent expenditure organizations. Basically, the for-profit making corporations have basically sat on the sidelines. And that's not too surprising when you think about it, because basically half the country right now is for Republicans and half the country is for Democrats. And if you were to give money to an organization that spends on behalf of one or the other, potentially half your potential clients or customers might not like that. And so, they're in the business of selling products and services, and they don't want to potentially tick off half of their potential customers. So most of them just sit on the sidelines, and that's not surprising when you think about it.
Well, so when we look at this, this was a 5-4 decision. The four more liberal justices said, okay, we're not on board with this. It easily could have gone the other way. What would have been the alternative? I mean, what would the world look like if they'd said, no, I mean, you can't make this movie about Hillary Clinton?
Well, I mean, we don't know, but it's kind of, to me, it's scary in the implications that the idea that the government could regulate, you know, book publishing if the book had any line of advocacy for or against a candidate, or documentaries for or against a candidate if they weren't bona fide, you know, news media outlets. Like, whoa, just think about that for a minute as a concept. We want the government to decide what is a true media outlet? I mean, are they going to give licenses to the media? How would we decide? I mean, the federal election laws, campaign laws, say that the media is exempt from all these regulations. Well, who decides what is a media organization?
Yeah, and particularly in this era where, you know, more and more, I mean, the traditional media, the traditional newspapers are dying, and you're seeing more and more of a transition to online news. And so there's not, you know, okay, I'm going to hold some newsprint in my hands and get some ink on my fingers really doesn't answer the question anymore. So what is a dividing line there? I don't know that there's any kind of clear touchstone as to what would be considered media and what wouldn't.
I don't know, but here is part of how the oral argument went, and the line of inquiry went a lot longer than this, but I'll just go to the end of it. So Chief Justice Roberts says to the government's attorney, so if a book has one name, one use of the candidate's name, it would be covered by the law, correct? Mr. Stewart, who's the government's attorney, that's correct. Chief Justice Roberts, so it's a 500-page book, and at the end it says, and so vote for X. The government could ban that? Mr. Stewart, yes, our position would be that the corporation could be required to set up a PAC and use PAC funds rather than general treasury funds. Chief Justice Roberts, and if they didn't do that, you could ban it? You know, question mark. Mr. Stewart, if they didn't, we could prohibit the publication of the book.
It's just such an extreme. It's such an extreme position for the government to take. Yet they took it in this case, and the court.
That's what the law. But that's
rejected
what the law
it 5-4.
They were just interpreting the law as the law was written and interpreted by the court previously.
Wow. So, you know, the response, the reaction from, and this has not been just isolated to the left. I mean, obviously the Democrats have been very outspoken in criticizing this decision and saying this was a bad decision. There has been some efforts on the Republican side as well to try and persuade, you know, Republican voters, oh, it was a bad decision, and they really don't talk about the substance of it. But the reaction has been to support things that essentially amend or repeal the First Amendment to the Constitution.
Exactly. Congress has in the past, and it's been introduced again this year, and in fact, just last week, they held a hearing in the House Judiciary Committee, Subcommittee on the Constitution, on a proposed constitutional amendment to allow Congress the ability to regulate speech about elections. So it would basically cut the heart out of the First Amendment, the ability to speak out about government.
Yeah, I mean, these are the most core issues that are protected by the First Amendment. Is, you know, who's going to be in government? What is our? Can we criticize government officials? I mean, these are at the center of the things that we want to protect and encourage free and open debate and discourse on.
Right.
Truly amazing. I agree with you.
I think the best way to think about legislators and government officials generally is that if they had their druthers, no one would be allowed to criticize them or go up and bother them up in the state capitol, meaning, you know, buttonhole them and, you know, urge them to vote one way or the other, or generate people to show up at town meetings and demand they vote one way or the other.
Yeah.
It's almost like they want to be philosopher kings. They want to be in office for life, and they don't want anyone telling them how, you know, how to vote or have any serious opposition at the next election.
Yeah. Well, and
if you say they all have that mindset, and then you look at the laws that they draft, you'd say, That's pretty much explains everything.
That it does. Well, the 10-year anniversary of Citizens United, a great decision, a great setback for those who want to silence Americans, a very good thing. We're running out of time. Tell folks who want to learn more about the work you all are doing at the Institute for Free Speech, great organization. Tell folks how they can connect with you.
Well, our website is this might be easier to remember. There are two ways you can get to it. One is freespeechforall.org, or you can just do our initials, IFS, like instituteFreeSpeech.org.
Great. Well, thank you for the work you do, and thanks for celebrating this very important decision and joining us.
You're welcome. Happy to be on with you.
Hi, this is Kerry Cheshire, Vice President of Texans for Fiscal Responsibility. The 2020 election will be here before we know it, and with every election comes candidates that need to be vetted and tested before we can entrust them with our vote. At TFR, we take that vetting process seriously. Any candidate seeking our endorsement must first fill out a comprehensive questionnaire, then sit for an interview with our staff. We then seek input from each candidate's would-be constituents before making a decision. To find out more about our endorsement process and view which candidates have made the cut, visit empowertexans.com/endorsements.
In a guest commentary this week, former State Representative Matt Rinaldi tells Texas Republicans they ought to be looking more closely at what's going on in Virginia when it comes to gun rights.
None of our rights, including the right to bear arms, are subject to the whims of politicians, polls, or even an electoral majority. Hi, I'm Matt Rinaldi with the Texas Scorecard Radio guest commentary. That was the message sent last month when over 22,000 people descended upon Richmond to protest a series of gun control measures proposed by Virginia Democrats. The leftward shift in the most recent election gave Democrats unified control of Virginia's state government for the first time in a generation, and they immediately moved to infringe on Second Amendment rights. But citizens and local officials have risen up en masse to refuse to enforce the unconstitutional proposals. Many of the protesters in Richmond were armed and open carrying handguns and rifles of the sort that Virginia Democrats are attempting to ban. The left-wing media ran headlines urging Virginians to brace for impact, yet the event was peaceful, with no clashes with law enforcement. The protesters even picked up trash and left the area pristine when they left. Richmond's murder rate is high, comparable to that of Guatemala. Despite media alarmism and the governor's state of emergency declaration, the rally was probably the safest the city's ever been. In addition to the massive public outcry shown in Richmond, more than 100 municipal governments in the state have voted to designate themselves Second Amendment sanctuaries and will refuse to enforce any new gun control laws. These protests are in response to Democrat measures to limit purchases of handguns in the state to one a month, end state preemption of local firearms laws, enforce mandatory background checks for person-to-person gun sales, and create a so-called red flag law. All of these proposals have already been approved by the Virginia State Senate, which has also called for a ban on assault-style weapons, though that bill appears to be stalled. So what should we learn from Virginia? First, our Republican system of government can be used effectively to protect against existential threats to our liberty posed by those in either party, if our elected officials have the will. Second, there remains a massive movement of citizens willing to go to great lengths to fight any infringement of their rights. The grassroots are powerful and need to flex their muscle often so politicians will take note. Texans need to demand more of officials who claim to agree with us. Third, our statewide leaders in Texas don't appear to understand the first two points. In fact, of the four gun control proposals that sparked the Virginia protests, our statewide Republican leaders have come out in support of two of them: background checks on person-to-person sales, and red flag laws. While our statewide GOP officials have seen polling trends and Democrat gains as a sign that they should take a more centrist position on issues like gun control, the massive and motivated opposition in Virginia should make them think twice. I'm Matt Rinaldi, and this has been a Texas Scorecard Radio guest commentary.
Well, that's all I have for you this week. If you haven't already, go on and subscribe to the Texas Scorecard Radio podcast, available on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Spotify. Make sure you never miss a program. If you're already subscribed, go on there and give us a 5-star review. That helps us find other listeners. Thanks for listening.
Texas Scorecard Radio is brought to you each week as a public service from the Empower Texans Foundation and in partnership with the Lincoln Institute and this station. You can download podcasts from each program and learn more at empowertexans.com.